What I'll talk about is based on two papers. One is one posted in the summer. One posted in the summer, and a very long one that we every week we say we'll post it that week and should be done pretty soon. And lots of the stuff is work in progress. You'll see, particularly at the end. So what we want to do is take another approach to constructing string-based models. And in this case, we want to compactify M-theory on the seven-dimensional G2 manifolds. Actually, let me emphasize the collaborators, Bobby Acharya, Konstantin Bobkov, who's a postdoc in Ann Arbor, and myself and Piyush Kumar, who's a graduate student of mine, and Diana Vaman, who's a postdoc in Ann Arbor. So I'll try and cover a big range of stuff. And you'll see I put a lot of equations on some of the slides. You're not meant to actually read the equations, except maybe to find typos for us. But they're to prove to you that we actually have equations and we're not just talking about all of the stuff. So the main, I'll have, after some, a little bit of stringy stuff, then I'll focus on moduli stabilization for a significant part and then get to applications in the real world of lots of this. There's a lot, or some, there's not actually a lot, there's some G2 phenomenological work, mainly focused on embedding the standard model, typically in an SU5 form, at hypothetical singularities in a G2 manifold. And the focus of the physics has mainly been on things like proton decay and hierarchical Yukawas. Those four papers have most of the phenomenological analyses and putting in the standard model in the SU5 form mainly, and so forth. And I'm not going to discuss any of that. Sergei talked about a little bit of that at his talk a couple weeks ago on the G2 constructions. But there's a lot of work in there, actually, that he didn't discuss and that I won't discuss, because I'm just going to focus on our own work. Our own work is to try and really generate the electroweak scale without putting in anything but high-scale numbers, and to fully maintain moduli stabilization. And we haven't done it, but presumably, and I'll argue just a little bit about it or in favor of it, one can combine what we're trying to do, which is mainly involving moduli stabilization and supersymmetry breaking, with the embedding of the standard model in those papers I showed you. No one is focused, for example, on what extensions of SU5 can be put in, or whether you can just put in 3-2-1 without SU5 and so forth. They tell me that you can do all that, but it's not been studied technically. Just one sort of propaganda perspective kind of thing. The hierarchy problem for phenomenological theorists is sort of like, not exactly like, but sort of like saying unified gravity in quantum theory, because the Planck scale is where gravity comes in and you have the electroweak scale far away, but then the quantum corrections, which can be even be big and out of control in general, can, to the Higgs mass and so forth, can connect the scales. So for many of us, it's the most important problem in particle physics. And that's, in a sense, what we're focusing on here. But to solve it without the moduli stabilization wouldn't be satisfactory. There's two different aspects to the hierarchy problem. You can stabilize it with supersymmetry at any scale, but supersymmetry doesn't tell you at all why there should be a weak scale or what scale you're stabilizing it at. So the real challenge is to get out the weak scale from the Planck scale or Planck scale, string scale type physics. It's long been known that that hidden sector Gugino condensation and non-perturbative arguments can give you a hierarchy, but the earlier work in the heterotic K case mostly didn't stabilize moduli and had potential problems along those arguments. And basically what I'm going to talk about today is to explain why we think this can work in the G2 case where we don't have small parameters. And again, just repeating at the bottom here that the hope for the next stage is that one can combine the standard model embedding and the kind of thing I'm talking about to make stronger theories than we have at present. I'll get a lot of generic results out, some of which are listed here. One of them that's particularly fun is that we only, in this approach, seem to get very light gluinos coming out. So if the gluinos are in sort of the lower half or two-thirds of the favored range that we get, then even in the low luminosity turn on 1 month run at LHC, they will see them. So that could be quite fun.
The
low luminosity 1 month run that they're talking about doing, or the first few weeks they would get a signal they couldn't miss in this range, and it could be seen at the Tevatron before that. So I'll do the phenomenology at the end. Now I want to talk a little bit about some of the string theory issues, and I'll come back to some of them. I'm pretty much an amateur string theorist, so I'm here taking things out of papers and things we've done, but I'll try and explain some of it. So we want to make a curled up seven-dimensional space that has G2 holonomy and supersymmetry. We don't need any fluxes to stabilize moduli in our case, and so we're going to work in the sector with no fluxes. And that we think of as kind of an advantage because fluxes tend to be at the string scale and make it a little harder to get low scales out of your theory if you have them. Not out of the question, but we're happy that we don't need them in that sense. There's a paper of Acharya, one of the earlier papers in this whole field, that argues that the non-abelian gauge fields can be localized in three-dimensional submanifolds and have orbifold singularities. And the chiral fermions, the standard model ones, for example, or in hidden sectors, you might have them too, are localized at points where there's conical singularities, and there's papers that have discussed that in detail, so one can refer to these things. We don't use a lot of the properties, but in fact, the weaknesses, I'll come to some of the weaknesses of these things as I go along. Mathematicians have, like Joyce and Kovalev, have constructed examples of G2 manifolds mostly without singularities, and that's not exactly what's relevant for us, but in a few cases we do some generalization to that. Then one can argue, in the sense that string theorists often talk about evidence, when I'm listening at least, that dualities with heterotic and type 2A vacua do suggest that there will be no problem finding singular examples at which you can do the standard model type embeddings. And we've worked a little bit on extending Kovalev's constructions with orbifolding to start to study some of the flavor issues, because we have to be able to calculate Taylor potentials to proceed. So one can say some technical words about this, but the main point is we can at least put in some orbifold singularities and know that we get Yang-Mills fields in these cases. And there are also similar arguments in the M-theory dual heterotic string where you identify certain things. So the upshot of the last two slides is that we don't think the lack of G2 mathematical knowledge will prevent going ahead with a lot of aspects of the physics. Now let me turn to what we directly do with moduli stabilization then. There's some general arguments, mainly made by Acharya, that in the G2 compactifications, the real and imaginary parts of the moduli will occur always in the gauge kinetic function and will in general have non-perturbative interactions, have to have only non-perturbative interactions for the axionic parts. And so in the zero flux sector, we expect that these things will occur. We're going to focus on explicit gauge-Eno condensation arguments in what I talk about here and in our paper, but there can be additional contributions. And the gauge kinetic function, depending on the moduli, means that there will be interactions of everything, and you expect isolated minima in the potential that you get from supergravity calculations. Here, today, I will explicitly show that the moduli are stabilized. That is actually construct the potential in detail. But these general arguments should work in a more general way and a guarantee that it works in more complicated cases.
Excuse me. When you say the shift symmetry is broken by non-parametric spectra, what do you mean by non-parametric? Because you are doing...
Well, I'll show you today exactly what I mean in this case. I'll assume Gugino condensation with... I'll assume Gugino condensation with a hidden sector gauge group, and I'll explicitly write the gauge group and the superpotential.
Is that non-parametric from the four-dimensional point of view?
No, it's in the hidden sector. Non-perturbative interactions in the hidden sector. Gugino condensation type chiral condensations or gauge field condensation is what I'm talking about today. There could be more general arguments, and in the papers by Acharya, they've written more general arguments using membrane instantons and things like that too. But I'm not, for our explicit construction here, I'm not going to use those. So we can think about the embeddings. A general thing is that if, as long as we have the gauge, the hidden sector and the construction of the standard model on three-dimensional submanifolds, in general they won't intersect in a seven-dimensional space, so there won't be light matter, visible matter fields that are charged under both gauge groups and standard model and hidden sector groups. So generically, supersymmetry breaking is gravity mediated in all these vacua. And mathematically, we don't know the Kähler metric and potentials for these vacua. But there is a set of Kähler potentials that has been written down that are consistent with the G2 holonomy. And some explicit examples were given in this paper a year and a half ago or so, where the Kähler potential has this form, and that's the 11-dimensional volume, and that depends on some parameters AI that actually depend on the mathematical structure of the G2 manifold, and we don't know, but there's a nice constraint on them that helps you, so you can then take rational numbers and scan over possibilities to look at what comes out if you're examining the consequences. So these AIs will, I marked a few things that will turn up later in the talk. You of course don't have to remember most of it as we go along. So we're assuming that we can legitimately use this to go ahead. Well, we don't truly know that, because we need to examine differences and things. We don't, as far as we can tell, it's not supercritical, and I'll come back to that at the end, actually. But until we can examine, until we have the mathematics done and can examine different choices, we don't know for sure that that's the case. So now we'll go through a procedure sort of quickly where first we look at hidden sectors with no charged chiral matter, and then we're going to add charged chiral matter the way Nilis et al. Did in a paper last year, or earlier this year technically, which actually was argued can raise anti-de-Sitter to de-Sitter and see that explicitly we can make that work for our case. So I'll go through three steps. So generically then, we assume the superpotential has this form from Gugino condensation. That's the hidden sector superpotential for the moduli. And we'll keep two terms in this. We can write some things, and we do write some things for the general case with n m terms. But 2 seems to give a pretty good generality. 2 leaves you a large supergravity region that you can work in. And we can actually do a lot of semi-analytic calculations with 2. We've done a few things with 3 or 4, but they get out, the calculations get out of control. And the semi-analytic calculations let me show you a fair number of results in a way that's really clear for understanding. The B's are just known coefficients 1 over the dual Coxeter numbers of the hidden sector gauge groups, And the A's are constants that are of order unity up to a factor of 10 or so. And they're, if you really knew what was happening in hidden sector, you'd know the A's. They depend on threshold corrections. And in the paper by Friedman and Witten, a number of the A's are calculated in specific examples. Well, you'll see it more for the gauge kinetic function right here, which is in M theory a linear combination of all of the complex moduli. And in general, the superpotential will be two. And in our case, again, we'll mostly leave these the number of terms in this sum and these coefficients more or less arbitrary. The n's are integers, though. And so, again, it's not hard to sort of scan over some and look at examples. So these constants really come from understanding, if you really knew as much as you know about Calabi-Yau spaces for the G2 spaces, you would then have concrete examples where you could write down all of these coefficients. We do not have that today, and that's one of the open issues. So we mostly leave them consistent with all the constraints on them. We mostly leave them open and play with them to see what the results look like. And I'll comment on both good and bad parts of that near the end. So for this Kähler potential, you have a diagonal hidden sector metric. So here's a supergravity scalar potential. You're not, of course, really meant to look at the formulas, except, as I said, to tell me the typos. But you can see that we've actually calculated it. And it depends on some of the things, like the B's and the A's that I've put in. And it'll be fairly obvious to anybody who's done these kinds of calculations what we're doing. So this is just the standard supergravity formula, and you get that potential. So now you minimize that and look for supersymmetric vacua in this case, and you find a condition for the solutions involving the axionic parts, and you actually explicitly find then for the moduli these values, and you have a set of solutions with all the moduli stabilized in that potential. And you can check that the volume is large enough that the supergravity limit is presumably a fair approximation.
Could you back up just a second?
What makes the volume large in this expression? Is it n?
Oh, it's not obvious. It's the volume is really the product of s's to some power. And so you have to look at it, but we've checked numerically, and I'll show you cleaner expressions for it a little bit later. We keep going everywhere. Every step we check that the supergravity approximation ought to be good in given what we're getting out at each stage. But you have to calculate it. It's not obvious. I'm sorry, I don't. With two moduli, you get a perfectly good result. You can do all these, with all these calculations, with two moduli, you get a perfectly good, clean result that makes sense. I think so. I'm not sure I understand, but I think so. We're not putting in any large numbers at this stage. We're just looking for sets of solutions which are minimum of the potential, and which we want to work in the supergravity approximation, so we keep checking that. We don't check that every single modulus is greater than one, for example, but only that the 11-dimensional volume is always at least a few in Planck units. So that was supersymmetric anti-de Sitter minima. Now we relook for broken supersymmetry anti-de Sitter minima. And again, I'm not going to go through all the calculations, so I will focus on the de Sitter case. But we find solutions. In particular, we can't exactly count them, but they're between 2 to the n minus 1 and 2 to the n solutions, where n is the number of moduli that you use. And that certainly works for a few up to 100 or something or more. They're still all ADS minima. Some are you get maxima and minima. And we've studied in the paper in a fair amount of detail these things. So I don't, given trying to finish the talk, I won't discuss them very much because physically it's the de Sitter one we want to look at. But they're there, and we enumerate them and give them in detail in the paper that we should be posting by next week, but it probably will be a couple more weeks because we keep finding either new results or things we want to check. So now I'm going to specialize and look at hidden sector gauge groups of ranks P and Q. So those numbers, those values will show up in the formulas from now on in some detail, so I'm just emphasizing them. And the moduli are fixed here where the things like C just refer to choices in setting the solutions. You don't really need to know what they are to understand what's happening. But again, explicitly, we've constructed the values of the moduli, and they're all stabilized. As I mentioned, we'll do semi-analytic examples to try and make more clear what's happening. And the only way we can really do them easily and get short formulas is when we take the two hidden sector gauge kinetic functions to be equal. So we've looked numerically at some cases where they're not equal a little bit just to see that we're not doing anything silly, but I'll show you formulas where they are. Then you can write the ratio of the two coefficients of the gauge groups in the superpotential this way, and the moduli are typically stabilized then at values that look like this, where nu is just a name for a function of the things that appear in the superpotential. So nu has basically got the ranks of the gauge groups in the superpotential and the coefficients, and this combination appears a lot. Now I'm going to turn to the de Sitter vacuum using Nilis et al.'s method of assuming there are chiral quarks and leptons in the hidden sector that have condensates. So that's an assumption, but a very plausible one that should be generically fair. and we're going to get another surprising result, so I'll warn you about it, and you can watch a little bit to see it happen. We're going to impose the condition that the tree-level vacuum energy cancels, which is typical in this kind of approach, but we're going to get a result that surprised us when we do that. And I don't think there's any cheating going on. So, put in the massless quark states in the Nilis et al. Paper, which is for the heterotic case. We generalize it then a bit to the M-theory case, and you get an expression for the superpotential like this. So the one of the terms then just has the meson field in it, where the that meson field is defined this way and has a magnitude and phase.
I forgot to say, what are the ZIs?
The Bs?
In the previous slide, the ZIs and the exponent there.
The Bs are just one over the
Zs.
Z.
Oh, those are the moduli. The moduli are
Z is
imaginary part plus psi times real part in our notation. Yeah. So then the superpotential will get to looking like this with this extra contribution, and the Kähler potential, where we're making some more simplifying assumptions that are not really known to hold properly, not known properly to hold for the M-theory case, but are plausible. Since the chiral fermions are at point-like singularities, the bulk moduli are probably not going to have big effects on the local physics around them in this kind of situation. And so we're assuming, partly just for simplicity, one can repeat these calculations without assuming that. It's just much harder to do them, and we've started to look at some of that and check we trust it, but not really gone very far. So we're assuming that the Kähler potential is canonically normalized, and we use one flavor, we could sum over them, and assuming the Kähler potential slowly varying near the singularities, so you just then get the meson condensate term in the Kähler potential and this extra change in the superpotential.
Those two Fs different, or it's the same F from
above?
F is the linear combination.
F is the gauge kinetic function that's a linear combination of the moduli, and we took them for this. To get these semi-analytic results, we took them to be the same for the two hidden sectors. You don't need to. It's just you get formulas too big to look at if you don't take them to be the same. That's all. But we've checked there that if we take them different, nothing seems to change in what I'm telling you. But I'm going to try and keep writing formulas that are comprehensible. And as far as we know, no approximation we make to do that is affecting the results. We tried to check most of that. So again, you get a nice big expression for the potential, which you want to minimize, and that takes a lot of analysis. And you find that you can get a minimum of the potential, and there's some moduli, and that parameter nu still looks like that. And now at the minimum, you fix the magnitude of the chiral hidden sector condensate just to depend on the P's and Q's and superpotential parameters. And you get another condition out, since this has got to be real and positive and you have a square root, then there has to be at least a difference of two in the ranks of the gauge groups for consistency. So we're looking for sets of solutions, and we need that with that condition, we can find solutions. So, phi naught is the magnitude of the chiral condensate of the quarks, chiral fermions in the hidden sector.
Okay. So you're also minimizing.
Yeah, we've done a full calculation of all the minima. This is just the value this gets fixed at. I'm not showing you.
Right, I'm just so curious what the functional dependence of the volume is on the integer input parameters, because in order to get a parametrically
controlled
solution, it must be that you're getting, you know, whatever
the
volume, some ratio.
Yeah, in the paper we have a lot of formulas that I think will answer that, but I didn't think to put them on here, and I don't think I can say it without looking at them. I'll have a little bit of information about that later, but not when I look at M1 at the 11-dimensional Planck mass. I'll say a little bit.
Are there ADS stationary points also, or
I first talked about ADS supersymmetric ones. We found up to 2 to the n stationary points.
Right. No, but here, in this case,
no, there are not.
They're only de Sitter.
Only de Sitter, and what I'll tell you in a minute is there's only one. So let me come to that just in a couple more steps. So first, the potential at the minimum is this. That is, you just evaluate it at the minimum by substituting in all this stuff. So then you look at the potential at the minimum, and you look for the condition that it be positive. Sorry. And that condition is this. So if we impose that condition, then you are guaranteed a positive, a set of solutions or solution with that's de Sitter.
So you're putting that de Sitter, right?
Oh yes, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Yes, we're looking for solutions that have moduli stabilized and are de Sitter, and we find one. Yes, there are. I misunderstood the question. Yes, there are other solutions if you don't impose this.
Right, but with that condition, which is just the condition on the parameters, there's only de Sitter.
Only de Sitter, and it seems to be unique to our surprise. That is, we've tried analytically to look for other ones and can't find them, and then we tried numerically to vary things and look for other ones, and we cannot find any. We only find one de Sitter solution that satisfies this condition. The condition is not hard to satisfy in general, and we only are able to find one. So maybe we're missing something, but at this point we only we find that the 2 to the n anti-de Sitter solutions translate into one when you ask that it be de Sitter. So that was a surprising result for us. Now, I've heard people interrupt with questions that say if you don't solve the cosmological constant problem, you should stop here. So I thought I would say what we do to deal with that, and then we actually get a surprising thing out about that too. So all you need to do is take the condition I wrote on the previous couple slides back and make it an equality, and then you get the potential at the minimum to be zero at tree level. So that's what you usually do in these kinds of calculations historically to do it. And these two terms then turn out to be fairly large when you look at examples. And so the radiative corrections to the conditions we think should have little numerical effect on phenomenology. And therefore we check numerically that whether we put it to zero or something else, it doesn't affect much the outcome masses. So we think it's fair to argue that when we do phenomenology with this, that the fact that there are going to be radiative corrections, which mean we haven't solved, of course, the cosmological constant problem, that they're not going to affect the superpartner mass as much. We find variations of 10 or 20% typically in the superpartner masses as we vary these things around. We haven't calculated the proper radiative corrections, but letting things be moved around all the way up to an intermediate scale, which is what you'll get normally for in such theories, we find that the superpartner masses, which mainly determine the low-scale phenomenology, are reasonably stable, not changing by even as much as a factor of 2. Gauge coupling unification is one of the things that's important, and all we can really check at this point without a more complete theory is that the 11-dimensional plaque mass, where you'll start to get a lot of corrections, is bigger than the unification scale. Remember, we're putting in a unification scale. We're assuming that the Gaugino condensation occurs at 10 to the 16 GeV or so. That's an input from us completely. There's nothing we know of that today that determines that. I actually mean to go back and look at the old heterotic literature where there may be something that you can say a little more, but I haven't done that yet. But this is coming out bigger. You can sort of see it analytically by looking at the volume and calculating this for different, putting in where we stabilize the moduli and calculating it for different sets of rational numbers for the A's, and you always find something. What we find is that if we vary the A's and take the moduli for the stabilized solution, that we're always in a range where the unification should be reasonable to have. The next thing you want to calculate to make contact with the real world is the gravitino mass, and so we do a standard supergravity calculation for that. In these formulas, then numerically, it'll be the reduced Planck mass. So you calculate a while and you get M3 halves to have this kind of form, again, depending on the superpotential parameters and that condensate and that volume. And you calculate some more and put in all this stuff, expressions for those to get it in terms of P and Q and such things. And the meson condensate simplifies a little bit. And we impose, we need to have a difference of 2 in the ranks of the group. So to calculate numbers and to visualize it, we actually take that difference to be 3 for the next part of the talk. And so M3 has a nice suppression, which I'll illustrate for you in the next slide. I'll show you the origin more of this on the next slide. And stabilized moduli. And this is the kind of amusing thing that happened, or maybe important. Let me plot on the lower axis the log to the base 10 of M3 halves. And then we reduce the number of parameters to 2 to scan. And we have not checked much what happens, just a little bit numerically if we change that. If we take at least 100 moduli, and that's presumably reasonable, but I don't know what the actual answer would be. We need to again look at them, learn more about the G2 compactifications. Then we find that we only get M3 halves that are right around a TeV out when we do that.
So 28 is not PRN dependent. You're going to show us where that comes from.
It's a little PRN dependent.
Okay.
And in the scan, that's taken into account. So the scan ranges over a large range of P and N, and that's all taken into account here.
But this is all with Q minus P equals 3.
Yes, this is all
Q minus P to 4, would it change?
The result basically is stable, but I'll show you in a minute. The most sensitive thing is the number of moduli, actually. And we have looked at other, in the paper there are 15 graphs like this with different ranges of different things.
But since you still do the math, which you work with, so how much of this really depends on the starting from 11-dimensional supergravity and say 10?
Right. That's actually a good question.
I mean, because the hidden sector, a lot of this scenario existed before all this other stuff.
So We don't really know the answer to that, of course, at this stage. What we can do is look at a lot of the things that are specific to the G2 case, like the formula for the volume and the gauge kinetic function. And what we don't have, we can't compare with a different compactification. The main thing that we get in a sense is we seem to be able to simultaneously have a hierarchy without any small numbers going in and stabilize the moduli and remain consistent with gauge coupling unification, all sort of obviously at once. And that's very hard to do in the other cases. It's presumably possible, but it's hard to do. So there are changes. But certainly one of the main things we're studying right now is what is the G2 dependence, but we need to know more of the mathematics to really give a good answer to that. So,
can't do
the studying. No, you certainly can't say you can't. It's just been hard to do it in other cases, and here it's easy. That's the main difference. And we're looking at sort of the simplest, straightforward part, and it falls out here. And it's more difficult in the other cases. So there are differences, and you can see how these things enter, but I'll come back to that. Here I've only changed one thing. Instead of looking at moduli, more than 100 moduli, I've included all numbers of moduli down to 2 or 1. And then you get some M3 halves that are large, and you get a tail at very small M3 halves, well below a TEV, which are experimentally ruled out, but not theoretically. So you can see then how it depends on that in particular. It's not nearly so sensitive to the gauge group in this case. And there are dependents on other things. So in general, the solutions don't all have M3 halves at a TEV. But if you take the most straightforward cases and a large number of moduli, that's all you get out, which we certainly hadn't anticipated. Remember also that this depends on setting the tree level cosmological constant to zero and using that condition. So this is not coming out for everything. If you don't do that, you don't get this effect. So that's kind of interesting. So note some things. Well, in terms of what I was just saying, we don't independently tune the cosmological constant to be small in the potential and set M3 has to be a TEV. If we do that, it's enough to get the TEV out. So that's kind of interesting too. Don't know how important it might be. Where that 10 to e to the minus 28 comes from is basically just, this is a known old heterotic result for those of you who are old enough to know that stuff. That is, M3 halves is the product of a Kähler potential factor that's 1 over some power of a volume and a superpotential, which is the scale at which the Gugino condensation occurs to the Planck scale cubed. And so you get automatic suppressions, which are sort of like these numbers, and that's more or less where the e to the minus 28 is coming from in practice, is just these nice intuitive suppressions that have been well known for a long time.
15.
So if you start with 10 to the 18 for the reduced Planck mass, you get 10 to the 3, which is a TEV. The full formulas have lots of numerical factors and details, but qualitatively, that's what you're getting. Those factors actually give you a TEV if you ignore all the factors of 2 and pi. So there's a square root of pi and such things. And I remarked once, but I'll say it again, that the loop corrections to setting the cosmological constant to zero at tree level should not be a big deal because the relevant factors were large. And then just note, the condition that makes the potential vanish at tree level is a condition where you're setting two things to be equal. And those things are big numbers, and so the radiative corrections to those will be smaller in general. We can't calculate them yet, but they look like they'll be significantly smaller. So we expect that condition to be more or less stable. It's just saying the phenomenology shouldn't change again when you do that, and it's reasonable, and we think we sort of understand that. That's all we're saying there. Not that we've solved any cosmological constant problems, but only that the implications of doing that should not change much in other cases.
Well, I thought usually you have to go somewhere pretty difficult with law, the different barometer and so here.
No, we are not putting a new thing in. We simply take a potential, and it's got several parameters and several things that are not known. In fact, I'll make a remark on that in a minute too. So those things are not known. Where a discretum will enter in is, if you think of that as, say, tuning the ratios of the coefficients, say, 2 over A1, that were in the superpotential, think of varying those. Then, in order to have an accurate cancellation of the tree-level potential, you need enough minima with, or enough ranges of values of those A's so you can do the calculation accurately enough. And we need to know more about the number of curled up G2 moduli that enter in, and so G2 manifolds that enter in, and so forth, to know for sure that can work. I'll mention that again in a minute. So the last point I want to mention here, just for understanding, if you take the log of the M3 halves formula, you get this thing which has appeared several times, and now that's going to enter in to some of the calculations of masses and things. So I'm just calling your attention to it. Okay, so we have to look at moduli masses and check that they're reasonable and that they don't give an automatic problem with BBN and so forth. So we do an estimate of those, again, in the simplest, only in the simplest case so far, where we take all of the powers of the moduli and volume to be equal, and then you can construct the full moduli mass matrix canonically normalized, which we've done, and in fact it has all non-zero eigenvalues, all are positive, n minus 1 have the moduli masses around twice M3 halves, and then for reasons I have no clue about, one of them is about 500 times that, but so that's amusing, and I doubt if it has any relevance, but it's amusing. And this is a nice confirmation that we haven't screwed anything up in finding the minimum, and that it is indeed a minimum and metastable appropriately. And in the mass, we'll put M3 halves finally from a phenomenological constraint at 3 or 4 TeV, and then we're in a region where probably we've escaped the gravitational moduli problems, but we haven't really checked that carefully yet, so we're probably okay. The next thing we want to do is calculate the soft Lagrangian and start relating parameters to phenomenological things. So we do the standard things where standard supergravity kinds of calculations. To calculate everything, we would need the Kähler metric for all the soft parameters and the flavor dependence. And we would also need the mu parameter, which I haven't mentioned much yet. We've started to look a little bit at how to generalize what we've done. There's a nice calculation by Bertolini et al. A year and a half ago or so in 2A, where they use orientifold constructions and then calculate, they calculate just the diagonal, but the chiral matter field Kähler potential. It's easy to generalize that to off that diagonal and flavor space calculations. It's clear from there. Paper how to do that, and then we can try and make duality type arguments to take this over into M theory and get some form which we can at least study, although we won't know it well. So we started to do that work, and of course anybody who is good at it is welcome to come quickly tell us that it works and get some results. But the most interesting thing we can get out is that the tree-level Gugino masses do not depend on the Kähler metric for the visible chiral matter at all, so we can calculate those. So we go ahead and do that calculation. First thing, it's automatic that they're universal since we're working on the assumption that we're using an SU5 embedding a la Witten and Acharya and collaborators in their papers. So if we stick to that for the moment and we're doing it here, then the Gugino masses at tree level are universal at the unification scale. And so capital M denotes Gugino masses. You get M3 halves times some stuff that depends on Q and P and that meson condensate, and they have a universal phase for the Gugino masses themselves. So this is really independent of lot of things. It's independent of the stuff that enters the gauge kinetic functions. It's independent of a lot of the internal manifold details, and it's independent of the number of moduli. That's in these approximations. So actually, I hope that it does depend on those things when we remove the approximations, but the leading piece clearly is not dependent on that. And the denominator is proportional to that logarithm of m3/2 that I showed you a couple slides ago. And logarithm of m3/2 is a big number. So we have a general statement in the solution completely that the gaugino masses are suppressed compared to m3/2 by a factor of 30 or so in this whole solution. No qualifications at all. A similar result was found for at least part of it by Quevedo and Conlin. That is a denominator proportional logarithm of m3/2. There's other differences with their stuff, but this result they also found. And numerically, I think Mary Kay's found things like that in the heterotic case.
Not numerically.
You have a general formula too?
Yeah, it's just the coefficient of the beta function for the condensing gauge.
Okay, good. So that's there, and it's important.
And it's a similar factor numerically, but it's...
Yeah, okay. So the numbers come out that the gaugino universal mass is m3/2 times about a factor of 40 when you put everything together in our formulas, and notice the minus sign. Then we have to calculate the anomaly-mediated contribution, so we use Mary Kay and Brent's and Wu's formula from some years ago and convert it to an M-theory one with a few changes and do it for our vacuum, so we get anomaly masses that have a big expression like this, proportional to m3/2. And if we put in all the details there, we then get out these different now for the three gauginos, and in particular the one for the SU3 group for M3, which will be the gluino, that is about half of the universal contribution and the opposite sign, whereas these are the same sign. So when we add them together, we actually find that the lightest of the gauginos is at the unification scale is M3. When you run down, this becomes heavier than the uncolored ones, but at the unification scale, it's the lightest, and it's not an Sugar-like thing. So it's the results are actually very non-universal, and the fact that this cancellation occurred for M3, but that they added for the chargino, and the chargino bound at LEP is the thing that you need to satisfy that sets some scales, but that's why we end up with quite light gluinos, and the general properties that make that happen are quite robust here, and don't seem to depend on any of the details. The numbers, of course, do. For the scalars, we've canceled V0 by setting it to 0, and there's the M3/2, and then this whole bracket is one thing, and the correction to 1 is actually the square of the M3/2 logarithm of M3/2 type factor, and so you get this term is quite small, and so you get a high degeneracy outcome for the scalars. That is, it's not anything we input, it just comes out automatically for the scalars at the high scale. So I'll tell you now some phenomenological results. We're doing a lot of these calculations carefully and extending them, but I can show you some things. First, for the dark matter, we have nothing very useful to say about mu. We just fix the magnitude of it by imposing electroweak symmetry breaking. We can't derive that yet because we don't understand mu in this context. It usually comes out larger than M1 and M2, which means you have a Beano-like LSP typically. And then an interesting thing happens, though. Often with a Beano-like LSP, you get too large a Rayleigh density, but we don't, because the charginos in our spectrum are only a little heavier than the LSP, 10 GeV or so, typically. And so you have strong co-annihilation going on there. And we actually find that a large fraction of solution space has a thermal Rayleigh density about equal to the observed one, and many of them are less. The parameters can give you more, but it's fairly rare. So everything I'm saying in the phenomenology section is based on running software and doing estimates, and we haven't had time to check a lot of things. So I think it's all kind of okay, but I don't know for sure. Flavor looks okay too, because of combination of the squarks and sleptons having, first, they're somewhat heavy, and second, they're very degenerate. And we expect the off-diagonal flavor effects from the Kaler potential not to be very big, from looking a little bit at the 2A1 and from the fact that the papers of Witten and Acharyan people got hierarchical. Yukawa's okay, and so smaller off-diagonal things. So as far as we can tell, we're not going to have any violation of flavor constraints, but we have to really calculate to be sure. We don't know that for a fact. It just looks pretty safe.
So that kind of thing usually requires some kind of symmetry of
the we don't have that symmetry. We just have the strong degeneracy of the scalars coming out of the fact that the correction to the leading term is strongly suppressed by that log of M3 halves. It was actually squared. I showed you the... No, and there's a scalar term. In the scalar masses, the M3 halves is multiplied by 1 minus all this stuff, and this stuff is strongly suppressed by the log of M3 halves type term. And so numerically, this correction is of order a percent at most in the examples we've sort of vaguely looked at. So that's just coming out of the dynamics of this, and we don't understand it better than that, but you can sort of see where the suppression comes from in the formulas, the supergravity formulas. So,
sorry, so where do the different generations come from in this?
We don't have that clean a calculation. Remember, the generations have been put in the Witten and Acharya papers and so forth. We've just looked at the... They've assumed singularities. They haven't got. They have not constructed manifolds that have those singularities. There's this. We're not using that though at all. We're just saying that we can calculate the scalar masses in supergravity, and the scalar masses don't depend on all of the kind of stuff about the way you compactify the singularities and so forth. We don't know that when you construct the complete theory, there won't be a correction somewhere. Where that would probably show up, what you're asking about, I think, is a mismatch between the Kaler potential and the superpotential, which meant there were flavor-dependent terms as you define flavor, and you would get off that, and it'll say Kaler potential elements, which then would enter in to these things. And we can't look for that because not enough is known. So if it's there, we can't say anything.
Without symmetry,
you generically
expect that to happen.
Sure. And so the fact that there are that they do have hierarchical Yukawas with small off-diagonal elements in those papers, plus the fact that this, if you look at this Bertolini calculation, where you put in flavor dependence in the 2A toroidal or antifold case, you don't see hints that there's going to be a problem there. So that's what I said.
Where did you put in the... Sim actually can reach an Agawas track, I guess, for the Kaler potential for the Manner field?
The Kaler potential had a meson factor for the hidden sector case. That doesn't affect this. Now we're talking about...
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Right. So we have not said anything about the visible matter Kaler potential at all in this.
All these degeneracy statements are statements about... So which degeneracy
statements? The scalar squark and slepton masses... are generically equal to M3 halves no matter how you calculate. Doesn't matter, their flavor is irrelevant.
The scalar drops out between the wave function and the potential.
I'm not sure I know what you're asking. There can be Kaler terms that couple the scalar, the matter fields to hidden sector fields, for example, or so on. So
we don't expect anything like that because of the point I made early, that we have three-dimensional manifolds in a seven-dimensional space. There should be nothing that has charges under both, as far as we expect. There's no reason for it. What limited thinking you can do says it won't happen. Yeah. So again, we don't know that we're safe from a flavor problem. We have to really work it out in an example. No one has enough knowledge to do that yet, but the indications are that we're safe because of just these peripheral things that tend to protect you. All the soft terms have one common phase. We don't know if that can be rotated away because we don't understand mu and its phase. If mu is real or has the same phase as the Gugino masses because of how it's constructed, then there would be no phase in the entire supersymmetric sector. At least that's coming out for all the soft Lagrangian for us, and we just don't know the case with mu. And then there would be no EDM problem of any kind, and probably much too small to be observed even. In addition, remember that the squarks were heavy, so there's a suppression there anyhow. So we're not going to have a problem, I think, there. But until we understand something about mu and its origin in this kind of theory, we don't know how to say more than that. No one has studied the phases of the Yukawas. The Witten and Acharya et al. Papers look at embedding the standard model in SU5 and families, but they do not look at the they look at hierarchical Yukawas. They don't look at the CKM phase, though, at all in those papers. That's an open, interesting problem to look at. We've done some LHC phenomenology already. I mean, we can see certain things right away without going into details, and we're actually working fairly hard on this as well. One point to make is that we've seen explicitly that it really makes sense to start with a string theory and carry it down to making calculations of masses. You get very distinctive kinds of spectra when you do that. If you think of signature space where you plot graphs with different experimentally observable signatures on the axes, then we occupy a certain finite region. That is, if you make any two-dimensional plot of signatures, we never come close to filling up any plot like that. And what we see is different from others. I'll just give you a couple examples. So in KKLT, you have both Gugino's and scalars lighter than M3 halves typically, and similar in mass often, as you vary parameters. So you get comparable production cross-sections for both. And because you're producing scalars, which remember the charges, then you get large charge asymmetries in KKLT, which are experimentally very observable. And whereas we only produce gluinos in our case, we get no charge asymmetries of any kind in the main cross-sections. So that's one. There are lots of differences, but that's one example of a very easy difference to tell. So any plots you make that depend on producing both of those versus one is very different. Lots of other things like jet multiplicities and so forth are also different. For the large volume Quevedo et al. Cases, only the Gugino's are suppressed, so that's like ours. But a nice and interesting thing happens. In their case, the anomaly-mediated Gugino masses are also suppressed by that log M3 halves, and so they have no cancellation. So then when they impose the left bound on the Chargino, they actually get forced into Gugino masses several times ours, which give you very different LHC results than much different cross-sections and so forth. All this kind of thinking is summarized for many models in the paper that Piyush Kumar and Jing Shao and I posted a while ago. And we started to look at our own signatures in that context. But they're very characteristic, and the most amusing thing is the light Gugino, which will be seen. So there's a huge amount to do, and it seems kind of promising to try and do a lot of this. The mathematics has to be studied, and there has to be analysis with singularities. One has to look at the full embedding with families and the MSSM. What's the situation with grand unification? Can you do without it altogether and just have 3-2-1 embedded at the unification type scale? Or different? Can you embed any group, or are there constraints? It's interesting to think about the statistics of the vacua and how the different, like the ratios of the coefficients and the gauge groups can vary, the hidden sector ones. We've only mumbled a little bit about inflation and looked. We haven't actually done a serious calculation yet. I've mentioned the mu problem a few times. Witten, in his two papers, does argue that you can have mu set to zero at the unification scale in the context of his embeddings. But it's not obvious to me that higher order terms don't allow an effective mu above the TEV scale. I hope it doesn't, and I have no argument yet that it doesn't. And that's something that could probably be proved fairly quickly by someone who understands the relevant stuff. In addition, you would like the effective mu to vanish when supersymmetry breaking vanishes. Otherwise, you don't really understand it and what's happening. And you want something like the non-renormalization theorems to operate in this case, and that would set the scale of mu properly. You'd really like to have the theory let you calculate mu from the underlying theory, and we don't know how to do that in this or any case yet, because once you do that, then you can actually calculate the Higgs valves and hopefully derive the electroweak symmetry breaking, which can be accommodated here but not derived, and really explain that sector of stuff. So then I've mentioned the phases a bit, what we need to understand, the phase of mu and the CKM phase, and whether all the other phases can be rotated away, which would be a really nice thing to happen. Check the flavor changing effects. Check that we don't have these BBN problems here. We haven't thought about baryogenesis yet and whether there's a favored way for it to work in this case. We better look at the axion situation and strong CP issues. Can we get, qualitatively it looks like you would get small neutrino masses, but can we really get small neutrino masses and maybe distinguish between hierarchical and degenerate? Is the LSP really stable in this approach? I don't know. That's something that, again, could be checked. Looks like it'll be a normal case, but I have not got a proof that there's symmetry which forces a stable LSP. There's a lot of good stuff that I mentioned then, so it's kind of reasonable string construction at this stage. You can do all these things simultaneously, and that seems really promising. This unique metastable vacuum seems pretty interesting, and whether things like that affect statistics questions is interesting. That M3 halves around a TEV emerging was pretty interesting. That the suppression is still there in that case. I've talked about most of these things, and they're kind of nice. We can just accommodate that radiative electroweak symmetry breaking. And another thing we're doing just for sort of fun in LHC phenomenology is taking that simple model with just two parameters, the rank of one of the hidden sector gauge groups and the number of moduli, and then you have to add to that tangent beta and mu to do full phenomenology, but we can give experimenters a four-parameter model with which they can repeat all the LHC phenomenology that they've done with only M-Sugra and compare things and see what's different. I mean, a lot of them are showing interest in that kind of thing from just when we talk to them and so forth. I'm actually kind of sad that we don't have stronger dependence on the G2 manifold space and the hidden sector gauge groups, because I'd really like to measure them. So if nothing depends on them, then you can't measure them, you can't learn about the string theory. They're always hidden in the correction terms and the extra terms, and untangling that is one of the things I would actually think is most important to do, is figuring out where you can learn about these guys. Generic results are fun a little bit, but they're unproductive, and I'm kind of sad that they're so generic. And we'll see what happens with that. So I'll conclude by saying there's going to be a workshop on G2 compactifications where we're trying to get together mathematicians and string theorists and particle theorists and phenomenological people, and the International Organizing Committee is this range of people that covers everything from the mathematics to the phenomenology. Just hoping to get people talking to one another about a lot of these issues in a way that's stronger.
Mass matrix. I think there actually is a good explanation for the structure you found, where most of the eigenvalues are one size and they have one large outlier.
Okay.
That's actually just a generic property of certain kinds of ensembles of random matrices. So.
Of random matrices.
So, in the large end limit where you have a lot of moduli, it's perhaps not that surprising that there's one large positive outlier.
Okay. That would be fun. So then it wouldn't have any physical significance to speak of.
I believe not.
Are just the scale of the hidden sector vehicles or
SU-10, 12, 8.
No, the energy scale.
Well, we input that energy scale at the unification scale. We just assume, that's the only input number that we put in that one number, 10 to the 16 GeV is where the Gugino condensation occurs. We don't derive that at all. And then all the other numbers come out with no parameters varying from unity by more than it.
Where is that put in? Why is that just an output?
Oh, if it can be an output, that would be great. I just don't know.
No, but why is that just an output of the...
If you can calculate that...
No, you have this potential...
No,
the integers in it, and it has.
Well, the potential is kind of invariant. Yeah, the potential works whatever scale you put in, as long as the approximations are good. So.
That's implying something about the theta function coefficient.
The potential in minimizing it doesn't depend on that scale being 10 to the 16. As long, all it depends on is.
Could you go back to one of the original potentials and show where that is?
Where
that 10 to the 16 is input.
It's not input in the potentials. It's input in at the stage where you put in numbers to get things like a TeV out and so forth.
You're putting in 10 to the 16 and the Planck mass?
Yes.
So the question is, that relation between 10 to the 16 and the Planck mass, where does that come from? That should be calculated.
Okay, I don't know how to calculate it, but I'm glad to learn.
Actually, that wasn't really my question. My question was where it's put in. In other words, you have these formulas which have e to the minus stuff in them. The e to the minus stuff is a
I haven't thought about it that way.
That doesn't matter. I'm just really asking at what stage in calculating, in minimizing the potential or whatever, did you put
it's in? It doesn't depend on minimizing the potential at all. You get to the solutions.
Would you put it in as a parameter?
The only place that.
You put it in somewhere as a parameter of the potential then. Right? Would you then minimize? I'm just asking,
I don't think I know the answer without going back and looking for a while. I just haven't thought about it that way. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the answer. I'll think about it.
Is the idea basically the compact dimensions are at the gut scale, and you're testing particle physics at the TeV scale, so it's not surprising that the geometry is not probable since there's a large hierarchy.
Well, I would like it to be more. Yeah, I mean, you're certainly not wrong in saying that. But the fact that if you live in a multidimensional world, you get a priori a different cosmology from if you live in a four-dimensional world. And similarly, you can see that there's dependence. A lot of dependence on things like the ranks of the condensing gauge groups and the number of moduli, but there's very little dependence on some of the other parameters. And it would have been nice if they were all there. And this general suppression of the Gugino masses means that the LHC phenomenology and its most characteristic features will be independent of all of those things, as long as that suppression holds, because you'll see Gluinos and certain kinds of events, and you won't be measuring that stuff. So you'll have to look at other aspects of it, which we haven't teased out here yet. Cosmology is not very different in that regard. Finding out the underlying things is tough, but you know that there's a difference there. So it may not work, but I really would like to learn more about the underlying theory.
I'm asking because usually a cosmologist uses this as a propaganda statement for why cosmology is better than particle physics. Because the early universe some colliders will never probe an energy that will let us know anything about fundamental theory.
Well, our model is actually a bit of a counterexample. I mean, yours depends on P and Q. In our case, everything depends on the data function in the sector. So, for example, there's a value which gives you the right dark matter.
Those are hidden in there in that parameter I called nu at some point. So there is some dependence on those, but only in combinations which make it hard to get at. And in particular, the gauge mass suppression doesn't depend on that. Once M3 halves is an order of magnitude bigger.
I'm a little bit confused because gauge mass is the cube of the constant scale, basically. The condensate scale depends on your gauge group in the hidden sector. That determines the ratio of one to the other. And somehow you rephrase that information in a different language, I think.
Okay, I'm not sure. I'll have to go and look at the way you do it and compare and see if we can rephrase it that way and seem to get more out of it. Yeah. And this is how we ended up doing the calculations, but it's too new for me to.
Okay, we decided we want about a TeV for the trap field mass. That forces us to a lambda of around 10^13.5 or something, because we have an extra suppression of the tension that beta function factor in the gauge mass. We just said there's just one factor for the gauge mass. There's three factors one factor for the gravitational mass, three factors for the the other one. Why there's a higher? But we start out with the fact we want the scalar masses are the same as the gravitational. We want that to be around a TeV, and that forces us to have. And so we have to choose the gauge
function,
which gives us that hierarchy.
We're not putting that in. We're not putting that in because we found from the calculation setting the cosmological constant to zero in this solution that we only got a TeV.
Because dynamically, those scales have to be related by the RGBs.
Well, there was an extra power, whatever, 10 to the minus 6 from the volume.
The volume factor does depend on some of the things in a nice way. But that's setting the scale of M3 halves to be within factors of a few, not more accurately, around a TeV in this condition.
Always have our moduli stabilize itself to a point, so they're always one, basically, or e to the I power 6.
Extra power of a million.
Yeah.
Our moduli are very different, not very different, but factors of a few different.
Somehow it seems to be the gauge group dynamics has to be in there somewhere.
Yeah, I haven't tried to track. Yeah, we certainly have to do all that. Or you can. but we have to understand all that, I agree.
I mean, roughly speaking, this power, the large hierarchy comes because you have a lot of factors of 10. There's radius 36, and radius is about...
And they're very physical factors.
And then the condensate scale cube, and that's about what probably... It's a
10 to the minus 8 or 9.
This is minus 3.
2 to 3 and near 3 typically, yeah. Yes?
So you might imagine that that's a fairly generic mechanism. Now, you said that's actually been appreciated in the literature elsewhere.
Well, I think my impression is the old heterotic literature basically has that same mechanism going on. The details differ, and there may be some characteristic G2 things that are helpful here, but we haven't traced that back either. But the basic mechanism is certainly old. I mean, in a certain sense, although it's not the way to think of the physics, what happened was that we realized you could retain that mechanism but stabilize all the moduli in the G2 case in a simple way, and that's what started us on this work. And then it didn't fall apart.